This is The Gauge with host Chance Conradude.
Are you freaking serious? It's Conrado. This is The Gauge, episode number 3. I am Chance Conrado. On this episode of The Gauge, we've got my good friend Stephen McBee from McBee Farm and Cattle and many other things. He's kind of a playboy philanthropist, and he is a great storyteller. I think you guys will get a lot out of this episode, so let's get into it. How was your flight, man? You flew in here to see us, and dude, I'm so excited to have you in.
Yeah, I'm excited to be here. I appreciate y'all inviting me down. You know, the flight's a little different. I think that was the quickest I've ever gotten onto and off of a plane. There was only about 6 people on my flight, so it's a little weird, but it makes it nice.
Sure. Yeah, it's a super short flight from where you came from in Kansas City anyway, right?
Yeah, it was like an hour, so it wasn't bad at all.
Yeah. So my man Steven here is kind of like he's a farming playboy philanthropist. So I'm telling you, and not to mention the hunting and all the stuff that he does, this is one of the most interesting guys I know. And I cannot tell you guys how excited I am to discuss this episode. But speaking of kind of the weirdness surrounding the flight, it's all due to this coronavirus nonsense. Nobody's being affected more than somebody in the agriculture business like you are. So can you kind of tell us what it's been like for
you? Yeah, absolutely. So to go into a little background on myself, McBee Farm and Cattle Company is a row crop operation. We farm corn, soybeans, wheat, and we also run a large cattle operation as well. So we're based in northern Missouri. We farm in Iowa, Missouri, and Arkansas. And generally, we run about 55 to 65 guys during planting and harvest season. And this year, I was actually planning on bringing over 20 South Africans on H-2A visas. Basically, it's an agricultural work visa. They can come in and work for you for 8 to 10 months and then go back home. And so, obviously, with coronavirus hitting, right about the time that these guys were coming in, international travel was shut down. So I had no one come over from South Africa. So we're running about 15 to 20 guys too lean, and we're just working through it. So it's turned into 18, 20-hour days, and tell you the truth, I'm glad to be down here enjoying this drink, because if I wasn't down here, I'd be in a tractor right now, so it makes it nice.
I was so excited when you were like, I'll get on a plane tomorrow. I was like, well, hold on, Steven.
Yeah.
Give us time to book the flight. We'll get you.
did you see I needed to get out of northern Missouri? I've been stuck in a tractor too long.
Oh, man. Dude, I have so much sympathy for that, because I got to imagine, you're the sitting CEO of that company, and mm-hmm. You're probably used to being in the office more so than out in the field. I mean,
that is correct.
You are probably so tired of washing the dirt out of your fingernails after the end of the day that you're just happy to be pretty again.
I am. I had some guys, some of my farm guys, I showed up, and like you said, I'm usually in the office more than I am in a tractor, but this year's been a little different pace for me. But I showed up the other day to our headquarters there where we keep all of our equipment, and I had some mud on my jeans. I was all greased up, had some oil on me, and the guys are like, hang on. Let's get a picture of this, because this doesn't happen too often. They're like, you're usually not dirty,
So they're never going to let you forget that you took your nail polish off one time.
Yeah, I'm used to pushing paper, so it's a little different for me to hop in a cab, I guess.
Right, I hear you. You know, the funny thing about McBee, your company, is you guys really haven't been around all that long for the size that you are, right?
No, we haven't. And so, a lot of guys are third, fourth, fifth generation farmers. We're first generation farmers. So my dad bought his first farm in 1998. It was specifically for hunting, which we'll get into the hunting side later. But we bought it specifically for hunting. And after a year or two, we'd cash rent it to the local farmer, and we'd go up there, and there'd be beer cans thrown upon our ponds, and there'd be random people fishing. And we're like, what are you doing here? And they're like, oh, the farmer gave us permission. And so after about 3 or 4 years of that, we're like, all right, that's enough of that. We're just going to farm our own ground, so that way we don't have random people showing up. So we decided to farm our own ground. There in 2003 is when we started. From 2003 to 2010, we grew to about 2,000 acres, maybe 2,500 acres at the most. And then I got out of college there, out of high school and college, right around 2012. Came onto the farm full-time, and from there we've grown to a 42,000-acre row crop operation. So we've grown exponentially here the past few years.
You know what I really like about the way that you guys operate, and I am by no means an expert on farming. After mm-hmm. talking to you for the last couple hours, I mean, I feel like I'm a little bit better. I'm like, maybe I should be a farmer.
Hey, anytime you want to come up and hop in a tractor,
just let me know. Yeah, it sounds like you're looking for workers. I don't know if I'm the type. But you guys are on the cutting edge as far as technology goes and kind of taking farming into the modern era, it seems like.
Yeah, that is correct. Like I talked about, most of the farmers in today's world are third, fourth, fifth generation guys. And so they have this notion that, well, my granddaddy did it this way, so it works, and we're going to keep doing it that way, you know, they're afraid to change. They don't want to change because along with change comes extra work and the fear of the unknown. And so whenever we came into this first with a first generation, we didn't know anything about farming. So we're like, hey, you know, we need to go to every single university study, every single university conference, you know, see what the latest and greatest techniques are, get out there, apply them to our farming operation and see if they work. And so we're not scared to try anything. And so what that's really led us to do is be on the cutting edge of what farming is really coming to. So now, you know, spraying our fungicides and insecticides, we're doing it via helicopter. The reason why is we can get in the field timing-wise better. You know, if it rains, a ground track sprayer can't get in the field for a week or two at a time, and those fungicides and insecticides have to be hit at a very specific time period. So we're getting in there with a helicopter and able to spray, you know, at those specific times. And that's just one of the things that we're doing. You know, we also have some fertilizers and some other inputs that are going in, you know, very, very leading edge technology for a farming operation. And so we take pride in that. And, you know, we want to take America, our mission statement is leading America into the future of ag. And that's really what we take to heart and how we go about making our decisions every single day.
Right. And one of the main reasons I wanted to have Steven on here, aside from the fact that he does so many cool things and he's just a genuinely good guy, and he has his hands in so many different things. His family has their hands in so many different things that are so helpful and beneficial to other people. You know, there's a lot of selflessness in what they do, but the fact of the matter is there's a humongous tie, and our mission statement is inside the Western lifestyle. And the thing about farming, rodeo, hunting, you can kind of paint those with a broad brush, and they all kind of go together. And you know, it's funny, you and I were talking about how they may be different hobbies, different walks of life, but it's all kind of the same high quality, good, morally sound people. And mm-hmm. You're definitely that. And it shows that you can do these kind of old timer things with a new age edge, but still maintain that same type of integrity mm-hmm. that say our fathers and grandfathers had. And it's just exciting to see a young guy like yourself do that.
Well, I appreciate it. And, you know, like I said, whenever we first got into the farming industry, we originally came from a fiber optic cabling company and got into the farming side and then grew it exponentially from there. It's what we found our passion in. And I think part of that passion lies in the fact that, you know, this industry, whether it be the hunting side, the rodeo side, the agricultural and ranching side, you know, this Western lifestyle, like you mentioned, it's all built upon this morally good foundation that I think we all have. You know, it's hard work, loyalty, dedication to family. You know, one of my favorite shows in Yellowstone is the scene where Beth is talking to Rip, and Rip's out there feeding horses, and he's talking, and he's like, you know, I feel like I should be doing something more important. And Beth looks at him and goes, no matter what's going on in the world, they still got to eat. And so all of us in this industry, we have this responsibility not only to our families, but to the animals and the ground that we take care of. And I think that there's an innate, you know, good foundation of morals built upon that industry. So
it's funny you mentioned that scene from Yellowstone, because that is like a scene directly out of my childhood,
mm-hmm.
except for there were some shits in there. But growing up the way that I did, and me and my sisters did on a horse ranch, because our parents were horse trainers, mm-hmm. it was 5 a.m., we feed the horses. I mean, the horses, yep. 7 days a week, ate before us. And just you mentioning that, it's like it just took me back. And I'm like, a little bit of PTSD from having to wake yeah. up at 5 a.m. and feed horses.
Oh, I hear you. I hear you.
But, yeah, I mean, that show caught a little flack for some of the beginning episodes. But stuff mm-hmm. like that, I mean, if that didn't hit home for every single person who does the sort of thing you and I mm-hmm. do and all these other people do, I don't know what did. Yeah. I am very appreciative, and I'm sure a lot of people are, of that show coming on and romanticizing the Western lifestyle in the way that it did, because it brings people to it from a different walk of life, and maybe they yep. understand a little more, and maybe don't attack it as much as they normally would.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it, you know, like they mentioned in that show, it doesn't matter what's going on in the world. It doesn't matter, you know, whether you're making money, losing money, those animals in that ground has to be taken care of. And you can bet the farmers, ranchers, rodeo guys, whatever this Western lifestyle you want to call it and group it in together is, you know, we're going to stand tall to the task and get it done. So,
yeah, absolutely. And the one thing you said is kind of how the hunting and the harvesting of animals kind of is what laid the groundwork and the foundation for mm-hmm. the farming and ranching that you guys do.
Yeah, that is correct. You know, we started off as passionate outdoorsmen. We loved hunting and fishing. And so, like I mentioned, my dad bought that first farm in 1998 specifically for a place for us to get away to and do that hunting and fishing. And You know, my brothers and I have grown up loving it. In fact, Jesse and I had even at one point we were involved in the outdoor industry, still heavily involved with it, just not so much on the TV side of things. But we love the conservation side to the hunting industry more so than the actual killing of the animals. You know, on the ride over here, I talked about how on the farms that we manage, you know, we manage them intensively for deer and turkey and high-end deer and turkey. And so, you know, we're putting in savings. We're putting in all this money into growing these big whitetails, not only just to kill them, but, you know, we enjoy watching them. For every mature deer that we harvest, we're probably saving anywhere from 150 to 200 healthy animals that we're feeding continually year in and year out on our dime. And so, you know, that's something that, you know, a lot of these guys from PETA don't understand is just how much we pour into the management and conservation of these animals, more so than just, you know, the grip and grin picture of us holding a dead animal. You know, there's so much more to it than just that. You know, the deer I killed last year had 5 years of history with this deer. He was 7.5 years old. I had sheds from him from the time he was two. And for those of you that aren't familiar, deer drop their antlers every year. So I had these sheds from him every single year from 2 years old to 7 years old. Ended up killing him there last year, last September. And, you know, every single time we harvest one of these animals, we have an emotional attachment to them. And so it's not just like this, you know, blood-hungry killer, we just like killing animals, you know. There's a bittersweet moment there whenever, you know, you do shoot an animal that you have that emotional attachment to. You get up to him, and, you know, it's a moment of respect and silence, and you really understand that, you know, what that animal means to you. It's a pretty neat feeling, so.
Yeah, I agree 100%. You know, it is something that's also near and dear to my heart, not to the level it is for you, but the big misconceptions are the type of lives these animals lead out in the wild. I mean, it's almost like you're doing them a service by harvesting them the way that you do. And I don't think a lot of people understand what it's actually like out there. And you're not just hunting in Missouri. You know, you've been all over the world.
That is correct.
And you've got to see things that some people only dream of seeing and some people dream of doing. And you even got to go to Africa for the first time this past year, which I think had to probably be the most awakening experience of somebody's life who's in that realm.
It was interesting. Yeah, you know, with my brothers and I being involved in the outdoor industry, we get to see some really cool places. We've been blessed to travel all over the world, Alaska, Newfoundland, Africa, Patagonia, I mean, just all over. And Africa was really neat, especially because I went over there thinking, you know, the only experience I had with Africa was from The Lion King. So, you know, I'm thinking a desert with maybe one tree sticking up in the middle and lions running all over the place. We get over there the first day and it snows on us. It was insane. In Africa, South Africa. Yeah, on the Eastern Cape. It snowed on us. Yeah.
I didn't even know it snowed in Africa. See, I just learned something.
Yeah, I didn't know either. I was not prepared for it. I was wearing a t-shirt. So it was cold.
Yeah.
But yeah, it looks more, that Eastern Cape in South Africa that we were on, it looks more like Colorado.
Really?
Than anything else. Yeah, the mountains of Colorado. And there's corn and soybeans over there. It's gorgeous. The views over there are incredible. And you never would have expected that unless you could see it firsthand. So it was really neat.
In South Africa when you actually went on the hunts.
Mm-hmm. I was. Yep. Yep. So we started off in the town of Port Elizabeth, and then we drove up the Eastern Cape to the north. We were right there along the coast. I think we were 50 miles inland from the east coast. But it was a really neat country getting to drive over there. And so, you know, the towns over there, the villages, I should say, you know, going on some of these hunts, you do get to see some of these third world countries and see how they live, and it really makes you appreciate what you have here in America,
right?
To say the least. I mean, you know, Jesse and I were in Haiti a couple months ago, and seeing Haiti and how those Haitians live, man, it makes you appreciate what we have. We're blessed to be here in the U.S. for sure.
Definitely, and I mean, we've got a lot of time because I really want to get into kind of the philanthropy work you guys are doing. You in specific are partaking in that because That's another thing that I think a lot of people in their minds, they think they want to do or they think they should do, but very few people have the balls to actually do it.
Yeah.
And so to know that you did that and recently are just starting to get into that, it's really an exciting thing. But I'd like to kind of circle back to talk about the Africa trip and kind of what you did, how it was structured, what led you to get there and all of that.
Yeah. So, you know, I've always wanted to go to Africa growing up. You know, you see these videos, like I said, you watch these documentaries of just, you know, whatever it may be, a herd of wildebeest running across the open plains of Africa. And it just inspires you to go over there and you're like, man, I've got to see that. And so, you know, my brothers and I had booked this hunt, about 2 years in advance. It was a mid-July hunt, which is winter over there. Flew over there and didn't know what to expect. We stayed in Port Elizabeth, which was an interesting experience. So the first night, we get to the house, and our outfitter tells us, hey, if you wake up in the middle of the night and you walk to the living room, there's going to be a guy sitting out there with an AK-47. Don't freak out. It's your bodyguard. So we're driving through town, and we get into the house, and there's like a 10-foot razor wire fence around the house. And so, you know, we stayed there that night, and I did. I walked out to the living room. There was a guy sitting out there on the couch with an AK-47. So, you know, right then, you're not in the U.S. whenever you get into a situation like that.
Right.
And so that first night in Port Elizabeth, it was interesting. It was really interesting. Not only that, I mean, the whole city is dark at night. I mean, you know, here in Fort Worth or wherever you may be in the U.S., it's lit up at night, basically. Over there, there's nothing going on. So, I mean, you basically see, heading to that house at dark, all you see is your headlights of your car, and that's it.
I mean, was there a time when you're there and you're like, I think I made a mistake?
Yeah, that first night. Yeah, I think we were all pretty freaked out, actually.
Right.
Yeah, so, you know, it was just, it was an eye-opening experience. And that's what a lot of these hunts are for us, is really eye-openers and just seeing how good we have it here in the U.S. And so, you know, after that first night, we got up into camp, and everything was all good in camp. You know, it was out there in the country. We were way out in the mountains. Didn't deal with, you know, anything else like that first night there in Port Elizabeth.
Sure.
So, but yeah, hunting in Africa, it was different than anything I ever experienced. Number one, I thought it was going to be flat. So I did zero cardio going into the trip. And then you get out there and it looks like Colorado. Mm-hmm. So it was definitely out of shape for the trip. But as far as the animals go, I mean, it was amazing. I was always watching my back, you know, walking down these trails, these wooded trails. I was thinking they're, you know, maybe lions or jaguars, because that's what you just come to expect from
Wait,
Africa.
It's just a nervous
thing. Oh, yeah. You're constantly thinking, like, there's going to be a lion behind a tree.
Right.
Ends up in Africa, there's only certain spots in Africa that have lions. So,
and you were nowhere near the lions.
No, nowhere near.
Were they laughing at you? Like, were the guides like,
oh, yeah, yeah. Like, I was freaked out. I mean, walking around, you know, you're walking down some pretty dark trails, and, you know, you're like, Jesse and I, my brother and I, we're keeping an eye behind us. I mean, we're like shaking down some of these trails because it's so dark. It's the middle of the day, but it's so dark and so quiet over there. It was a little weird. Didn't learn till the end of the trip. They told us, hey, there's no lions within 250 miles of here.
So they're just making fun of you guys the whole
time.
Oh,
yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, we'll tell them after. Oh, yeah, let
absolutely.
Them be scared the whole time.
Absolutely. Yep. So it was really neat, though. You know, I think I harvested 11 animals, all with my bow, all free range, so which is a big aspect to what we do. You know, we always are wanting to hunt free range animals.
Right.
You know, I don't like hunting animals in concessions. I don't like hunting animals in a high fence. It's not very sporting to me.
Sure.
You know, and to each their own, but you know, we always want to go on free range hunts, and so we make sure whenever we go to every outfitter that you know, they tell us, hey, you know, this is 100% free range. These animals have, you know, they can travel wherever they want to go, and
right.
That's a big deal to us for the sporting side of it.
Yeah. While you were there, I mean, what was kind of the standout animal that you harvested that you were just like, this is the most amazing creature I've ever harvested?
So the Nyala, for sure. So I was able to harvest an eland, which is huge. It's bigger than a cow, like bigger than any Brahma bull you'll ever see. And then the Nyala was just the most gorgeous animal. I mean, it's got this beautiful coat. You know, it's a gray coat, fades into white. It's got brown legs. I mean, these animals are just amazing. But it's incredible over there in Africa, the diversity you get. You know, you just don't have that here in the States. In Africa, you may see 35 different species a day.
Wow.
So here's the eland. Whenever I told you it's bigger than a Brahma bull.
I mean, that is gigantic.
Yeah, like 2,500 pounds, 3,000 pounds.
Yeah, I mean, it's so much bigger than you as a human being, a decent-sized human being as well. Like, that's unbelievable.
Get
the size
this.
Of that animal.
So that animal there, that eland, they had a tracking dog. This dog may have weighed 5 pounds.
Sure.
So they use tracking dogs over there. So whenever you shoot an animal, these dogs track down the animal. So I shoot this eland, this 3,000-pound animal. This little 5-pound dog grabs it by the back foot and takes it down.
What?
After I shoot it. Yeah. True story. So we're sitting in the blind with my guide. I'm sitting there, and his little dog's beside me, and his little dog's just like going crazy. And I'm like, man, what is wrong with this dog? And so I draw back and shoot. And by the time this eland runs 40 yards, this dog's on its heels, grabs it by the back heel, takes the whole animal down, and goes right back in to try and, I don't know what he was trying to do, attack it or whatever. And this thing kicks, and this dog goes flying like 25 feet in the air.
Oh, my God.
As soon as it hits the ground, it's back on the eland again. These things are little terrier. It was a Jack Russell Terrier. That's what
it was.
It's
a Jack Russell?
Yes.
Okay, they're monsters.
Let me tell you right now, I will never jack with a Jack Russell Terrier, ever. Those little things are crazy.
That's unbelievable.
It was.
The fact that is there's not very many animals that weigh 3,000 pounds.
No, it's
huge. And to see you sitting next to that thing with a bow and then describing the story of this little dog attack. I can't mentally imagine even what that looks like.
It's pretty wild. The animals over there, like I said, there's just so many species. It's such a neat place.
And so kind of explain to me, because I understand like how the conservation works in Africa. You have to pay to shoot each of these animals.
That is correct.
How much of that goes to conservation? It's like 90% of it almost, right?
Yes. So you have conservation fees, whether it be anti-poaching, paying for the anti-poaching guys, the workforce over there. All of the meat stays in Africa. So we did not see any of this meat, but what we were able to do is take it to the local villages and donate it. So that was a pretty neat experience, being able to be there with the kids and hand out this meat. And, you know, they're so excited just to be able to have the food that they have, you know. And so it was such a cool experience being there to hand out this, you know, whatever animal it was at the time that we had killed, being able to hand it there to the village, and they were so appreciative, and they had, you know, they would dance around a fire in celebration of this meat. It was a really, really neat experience.
And that's the thing that people who are so against, we'll call it trophy hunting, because that's the term that a lot of the drum beaters use. Mm-hmm. That's the big misconception that they don't understand, is that without this money that's being paid from people like you or anybody who goes over there, and even down to the meat, their quality of life would be terrible without these dollars and the meat that's being harvested and given to them.
Absolutely. These species would not be around in today's world with the population of humans we have if it wasn't for hunters and the money that goes into conservation through these hunts. So, you know, let's say this zebra, and I took some flack on social media for killing a zebra with my bow. There's no doubt about it. But this zebra was a 16-year-old male. He wasn't even breeding anymore. He was all by himself because he's no longer breeding. He's too old to breed. You know, I paid a certain amount, you know, for the trophy fee to kill this free-range animal. But in effect, you know, that trophy fee goes towards anti-poaching labor force. The meat from the animal is also donated to the local villages. And this is an animal that probably would not have made it through winter anyways, or would have died due to predators or some horrible death. Whereas, you know, I shoot it with a bow and arrow. It's dead within 45 seconds. And then it helps out so many more people and really helps the population of zebras even more so. And so that's just something people don't understand about conservation, is the work that hunters do literally bring back and keep the populations of these animals alive.
It's a thankless job almost that you get. I mean, okay, so there's the benefit of you get to go through the whole experience, harvest the animal, do things that a lot of people don't get to do. But unfortunately, it just seems like that now it's been a little bit more romanticized as of late, because you have these big names, like we were talking about, the Cameron Haineses and the Joe Rogans of the world, who have helped with their huge reaches kind of change some of the misconceptions that are surrounding this. But even still, you'll still, just like you, I mean, as far as your media presence, it's nobody's, just compares to those guys in this type of industry. But I mean, you got absolutely crucified for posting a picture of a zebra.
Yeah, absolutely.
But there's no way to truly explain everything you just explained to somebody on a post.
Not at all. You know, you receive, you know, there's a lot of my friends that even have bigger social media followings, you know, for the hunting industry, that'll receive death threats, literally death threats, because of, you know, what they do. And that's just hunting. And, you know, they'll post a picture of a certain animal that they kill, and they're just absolutely crucified via social media. And it's just ridiculous to see this because of all the good that goes on in hunting. You know, on the ride over here again, we talked about the grip and grin, and we said how that was just such a small aspect to what we're totally doing as hunting. You know, I may go 3 years without shooting a deer on my farm. And the one time I do shoot a deer, generally it's a mature buck that's over 7 years old, basically not even breeding anymore. And in that 3 to 4 year period that I didn't shoot anything, I was feeding upwards of 200 to 250 animals. So, you know, there's so much good going on in the hunting and conservation realm that just isn't even, these people don't even think about whenever they, you know, are posting death threats to you.
Well, they don't know. You know, yeah. It's a keyboard warrior mentality.
And so you have these guys, you know, Joe Rogan, Cam Haines, another one I really, really like. And I, you know, the way he's able to word what hunting really means to us is Donnie Vincent. You probably have never heard of him. He's got a decent following, but some of his videos are just incredible. So I highly recommend guys that are interested in hunting, are hunters or even non-hunters, to go out and check out Donnie Vincent's stuff, because the way he words it, it's just incredible. And it really does a good job showing, you know, what we're all about as hunters.
Absolutely. You know, and it's probably one of the most beautiful things in life, because it's been around since the beginning. You know, you go to Burger King, McDonald's. Our producer here, was eating Whataburger, and this is not a pitch for Whataburger, but he was eating Whataburger, and probably didn't even think about what the life was like for that animal that was in between the buns. Mm-hmm. You know, you don't think about that. And when you're doing the kind of harvesting that you're doing, or anybody who hunts is doing, it's so much more honorable to kill your own. And you know, that's what it always comes down to is it's an honor thing.
Yeah, absolutely. Like I said, you know, there's a respect moment there whenever we have, you know, an animal on the ground that we have that emotional attachment to. And then, you know, there's something to be said about, going out and doing your own grocery shopping too. It's a lot better feeling than going out to the store and buying, you know, prepackaged meat. You don't know, you know, where that animal was raised, what was pumped into it, what hormones, what steroids were pumped into it. Whenever you go out in the wild and kill your own groceries, you know, it's non-GMO meat for sure. You know, it's grass-fed, and you know, it's going to be of the highest quality, and there's going to be no medicines or hormones put into it. So
absolutely. Yeah. And it, I mean, it, I will say when it comes to wild game, I eat a pretty decent amount of elk. Mm-hmm. It is an acquired taste. So, you know, what's interesting, if somebody ever shoots their first animal, they're so excited about it. And if you ever get to see that person who eats their first piece of venison or elk, it's almost like there's this excitement. They think they're about to eat a steak from a Morton's or something like that. And you see the look on their face. It's definitely an acquired taste.
It's a little different. Yeah, you can definitely tell a difference. You know, everyone likes to say, oh, you know, that tastes, everyone's favorite saying, oh, that tastes like chicken. No, it does not. It does not taste like chicken.
And it tastes like its own thing.
yeah, it does. You get used to it, though, and it ends up being not too bad. But, you know, for anyone that hasn't tried wild game, I suggest trying it in maybe chili, lasagna, you know, putting it into a mixed seasoning or something like that to take the wild out of it, more so than just, you know, slapping a steak on the grill for, you know, yes, an elk steak or something.
I can tell you there's only a couple cuts on an elk that work well, like seared like that. It's like a back strap or something like that.
Yeah, absolutely.
I will say, and this is not a pitch for Traeger. They don't sponsor us, but that pellet grill will change the flavor of wild game like nothing else. I don't know if you've got one.
Oh, yeah, I've got one. It's my saving grace, actually. Here's the thing about a Traeger, and I do not understand how it's able to do this. So the other day, I had a couple steaks on the grill, got busy. I can't remember what I was doing, but I ended up leaving my house, forgot about the steaks for 3 hours. On a normal grill, though, you'd come back and those steaks would be like a brick, like you'd smack. I still ate them, and they were good.
Really?
I think it's impossible to jack up what you're cooking on a Traeger.
It's, you know, I was talking to a good buddy of mine who is by no means a chef, and he's just like, you know, I don't like to cook. You know, I'll eat a bologna sandwich. Like, dude, you're not living.
Yeah.
You can go buy the crappiest cut of meat, go buy the cheap spare ribs, put some of the Traeger seasoning on them, put them on there, even on high, and you're going to feel like a king.
Oh, it's
like,
amazing.
It is easier to cook with that than a microwave.
It seriously is.
In fact, they might sponsor this show because we're talking so high.
Well, that's what I was going to say. Traeger, Stephen McBee, just...
Yeah, hit me up. At Stephen McBee at the Gage Podcast. Help us out. We could use one in studio, I think.
That's exactly right. That's exactly
but,
right.
But kind of going back, there's one thing that you and I talked about, and it's on your Instagram there. There's a picture of you with these children from Haiti that when you see something like that, and it's actually somebody you know, it creates this emotional response for me because, and I'm by no means an emotional guy, but after talking to him, I'm like, okay, this is probably one of the most relatable guys and the kind of guy that I can just sit and shoot the shit with, as I say, and lose track of time. And and I just, tell me, I already know, but tell us about the trip to Haiti, what that's about, and this philanthropy work that you guys have started doing.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, like I said, my brothers and I have recognized, you know, how blessed we are, number one, to live in this great country, but number two, you know, the business success that we've had. We understand that, you know, we're so blessed to have what we have, and what we really want to do in this life is make sure that we have businesses that are not only for-profit, but in that for-profit business that we're also finding ways to give back to, you know, whether that be communities or in our own country or communities in other countries. So on the hunting side, you know, one of the things that we just did here in January is we had a hunt for kids that have a debilitating disease, you know, whether it be cancer, whether it be, you know, they're in a wheelchair for their life, whatever it may be. So we brought them up to the farm and had them hunt with us. And we like doing that once a year. We had 8 kids up this year, and that was a really, really fun hunt. And then in the Haiti side, we have a startup going called McBee's Coffee and Car Wash. And so what it is it's an express car wash. And basically at the touch screen where you order your car wash, at the end of every car wash, you get to choose a coffee or a water, whatever it may be, as a beverage of choice for whenever you're riding down the tunnel getting your car washed. And so since we're already sourcing this coffee, my brother and I have thought up, man, what better way to give back to a community than if we source this coffee, providing jobs to the community, And then all the profits in that coffee that we purchase goes back to that community. And so I was able to partner with a former Cardinals pitcher, Kyle McClellan, in his program called Brace for Impact 46. And what they do is they went down there and they built an orphanage that has a school, housing, you know, provides clothing, books, food, whatever it may be. They have this oasis in the middle of Haiti, which is it's a horribly rough country. I mean, it's bad down there whenever you're down there. But they have this oasis for these kids, you know, where they're really raising them up through the school program, giving them education, and then even up past high school, giving them the vo-tech needs that they need to be successful down there in Haiti. Because at the basic level, you know, education changes lives. And so that's what their whole focus on is educating these kids, getting them prepared for real life and being able to get them out into the workforce and giving them good jobs to where they can be productive members of society. And so this coffee that we're purchasing, number one, is providing jobs down there in Haiti. It's sourced in Haiti and it's damn good coffee. You know, it's not junk coffee. It's some of the best coffee I've ever had. But then all the proceeds from those coffees, so for every 24 bags of coffee we buy, it sends a kid to do that school for 1 year. It covers all their expenses. So we're hoping within year one of opening up this car wash, we're able to send 100 kids to school. And so it's just some of those things that we're doing. You know, it really isn't that much more difficult on our side, you know, through our supply chain to find those suppliers that are able to, you know, help out those poorer communities. But it really gives us that feeling of, hey, you know, not only we're doing something for profit here, but we're doing something good on the backside here through our supply chain. And so we're really excited about that program.
Yeah. Yeah. So what was it like in Haiti? Like you got there. I mean, you went to Haiti after the Africa trip, right? Mm-hmm. So you had already kind of had a little bit of third world experience.
Yeah, there was nothing like Haiti, I can tell you that. So Africa, you know, was one level. Haiti was three times that level. I mean, there's, you know, going through the streets, there's just on each side of the street, there's 5 foot of trash. There's trash in the rivers. There's pigs feeding in the rivers. It's unbelievable, honestly. It's say it's eye-opening would be an understatement. You know, the food that they have there, it's just everything is malnourished there. So malnourishment's a huge issue. They're not getting enough food. You know, the doctors and the teachers. So one of the cool programs about Brace for Impact is they're sending American doctors and teachers down to teach the Haitian doctors and teachers, you know, how we go about things in America. And it's a tricky subject because you don't want to come down there with like an American arrogance saying, hey, our culture is better than yours. We know more than you do. So we're going to come bring you our culture and you need to start fitting it into yours.
Right.
You know, it's just trying to bring up that education level because half or more than half of the teachers in Haiti aren't even qualified to be teachers. And so, you know, as they're teaching kids these things, they aren't even qualified to be teachers themselves. And so like I said, the education aspect of it is huge to bringing a third world country up to par with the rest of the world and bringing their economy back. And so, you know, what Kyle's doing, and there's a bunch of other former Cardinals players and heck, even, you know, current Cardinals players that are down there investing in that Brace for Impact program. It's just, it's awesome what they're doing.
Yeah. It's gotta be so fulfilling to be a part of that. And I mean, how could you feel any negativity towards anybody, whether it be a baseball player, anybody who's in any kind of economical standings, if they're doing that. And it's amazing to hear that. How long were you there though?
We were there for 4 days. So we were there for 4 days and we'll probably, you know, from here on out, it'll probably be a 3 to 4 time a year trip. You know, there's a bunch of guys, pretty, you know, well-known guys, Andy Frisella from First Form, they send a group down there every single year. They're investing 30 for the kids from First Form. A lot of you guys will probably know about that program. That's all based for that, Brace for Impact program. You know, there's a lot of really well-known companies and guys, you know, whether it be from the sports world or the protein supplement world that are down there helping these kids out. So it's an awesome program.
It sounds awesome. Yeah, anytime anybody's giving back. An interesting transition from that, you were showing us some pictures of this grizzly bear. Like, I want to hear that story about the bear.
Yeah, yeah. So we talked
different subject.
Yeah, there. It's a little different right subject.
That is a monster.
So backstory, you know, I talked about how we have hunted in Africa, you know, Patagonia, Alaska, Newfoundland. This is an Alaska trip. My brother and I went on this, didn't know what to expect. We wanted to go on a caribou hunt, so we went to the North Brooks Range in Alaska and stayed in a tent for 8 days with our friends Josh and Sarah Bomar and a guy named Tim Wells, who's well-known in the hunting industry as he hunts everything with a spear. This dude's crazy, right? So absolutely crazy. So we go up there expecting to hunt caribou. Ends up, it really wasn't a hunting trip for us. We ended up getting hunting more than we did hunting ourselves. So we seen in the 8-day span, we're there 40 grizzly bears and 5 caribou. This is one of the grizzlies that was tormenting us the entire time we were there. So if you see, those claws are at least 4 inches long. And this bad boy, this is 30 yards from Tim. So basically, Tim had a spear and a longbow. And he had a grizzly tag, but you're not allowed to kill grizzlies if you don't
now,
have a
guy. Now,
when
you say longbow, you're talking about...
like a wooden bow.
A wooden bow.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he's not using a high-tech like Hoyt or something
No, it's a wooden bow. Yeah, this dude is absolutely nuts. He's awesome, but absolutely nuts. And so the entire time, he was trying to get a grizzly bear to charge him so that he could legally kill it. You know, he was like pumped about this. So this grizzly bear, this is a male big boar grizzly bear here, and it kept messing with us the entire time throughout camp. So one day, you know, Jesse and I are up on this ridge glassing, and you can see miles in Alaska. You can see 20 miles up there in North Brooks Range. It's wide open. And we see Tim walking. We're looking through our binocs, and we're like, oh, yeah, there's Tim. And we're like, what is that in front of Tim? And literally 100 yards from him was this grizzly bear. And Tim's walking towards the grizzly bear. And we're like, surely he sees it, right? Well, then the grizzly bear stands on his hind legs like this at about 100 yards, charges Tim, gets to about 30 yards, and is still running at him. And Tim, he self-films everything, so he's got his tripod and his camera. And he's just sitting there messing with his tripod and his camera. And Jesse and I are like, he's going to die. Like, he's going to get eaten.
We're going to watch this fucking guy die.
And there's nothing we can do about it because we're 3 miles away. You know, there's specks out there in our binocs. Well, Tim gets the camera set up, and we see him turn. And he's got his longbow, and he's like, oh, yeah, bring it on. And we're like, okay, at least sees him. Well, this bear stands up at 30 yards. This is from Tim's camera. So this is at 30 yards. This man-eating, who knows, 1,400-pound grizzly bear is at 30 yards from Tim, and he's just got a longbow. And he's pumped about it. Luckily, the bear hit the ground, runs off. So this bear was so intent on, I don't know, eating human blood or eating human flesh. It's running off about 500 yards from Tim. Our other buddy, Josh Bomar, was hiking up this hill. He's probably a mile and a half up the hill. This bear cuts his trail. And it's like a bird dog. As soon as he hits the trail, he starts following him.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. So he starts following Josh, and Josh is watching this happen. He's way up on a hill. So he's looking down at this grizzly bear, and he's like, man, this thing's kind of coming at me. He's like, it's coming at me pretty hard. And so Josh has a pistol, gets out his pistol, and he's like waiting there. He's like, man, I hope this bear doesn't really, you know, come at me or anything. Takes off on a full run towards him. So Josh is screaming bloody murder trying to get this bear to stop, and he's not stopping. Gets to about 50 yards and cuts into the brush. This brush that's right beside Josh, probably 10 foot.
And you guys
brush.
Lose sight of him.
Yeah, you can't see him at all.
Oh, my.
So Josh is sitting there screaming like bloody murder with a pistol, like thinking he's about to get it on with this bear. And luckily, nothing ended up happening from that. But that hunt was, it was miserable. I'm not going to lie to you. It's one of those things that you have to do, but you'll gladly never do it again.
So you're probably never going to do that again.
Not that hunt, no. Yeah. So, I mean, you know, basically... walking in the tundra, you're sinking to your knees every single step, and you have these bushes that are basically like walking on a wet sponge, and so you're rolling your ankle constantly, and so, you know, something like a bear can cover that ground easily. You're sinking to your knees with every single step. There's mosquitoes. My brother's face was so swollen, he couldn't see out of his eyes. So the first day, you know, they told us, hey, don't shoot a caribou more than a half mile from camp. You won't want to hike back, you know, you won't want to hike the whole thing back to camp from more than a half mile. That's how hard it is to walk out here.
Right.
There was no caribou around us. You know, we flew in the day before. We didn't see a single caribou. We're like, well, this is not good because we just went 150 miles, did not see a single one.
Right.
So the first day we hiked 10 miles into the backcountry. And we're sitting there like out of breath, can't even breathe. And we look up and there's this giant caribou coming over the hill. And it's running like diagonal to us. So we're like, oh, man, we got to catch up to it. So we take off sprinting and we make it like 200 yards. It felt like a mile. And
you guys are hunting with bows, mind
yeah,
you.
Yeah, oh, yeah, hunting yep. with bows. Did not have a chance in hell of catching this caribou. It's like 3 miles ahead of us now at this point. We're like, damn. Well, let's just sit here and eat some lunch. You know, this is the only caribou we've ever, you know, we encountered basically the entire trip.
Right.
And so we're like, well, let's just sit here and eat some lunch. You know, it's a waste. You know, we're never going to see anything else again. Whip open our sandwich, and we're watching that caribou. He's like 10 miles away now. Thing does a U-turn. These things never stop moving, mind you. Like, they're constantly running because there's so many bugs and mosquitoes, they can't stop running. Otherwise, they get bothered by them so bad.
Right.
Does a U-turn, runs 10 miles back to us, stops in the only patch of grass 40 yards away, and starts eating. So, we put down our sandwich. My brother grabs his bow, shoots the caribou. Just like that.
And that's that.
There's no cover. Like, there's no way you're stocking up on anything And this thing was 10 miles away, does a U-turn and comes back 45 yards and stops and just starts eating. And we have it on film too.
I got to see that video at some point.
I'll show it to you. Yeah. It's the bomb. It's awesome. So anyways, we killed that caribou. We had it completely cut up and in our backpacks by, let's say, 11 a.m. It wasn't any later than 11:30 a.m. 10-mile hike back to camp. It doesn't get dark in Alaska. We didn't get back till 2:30 in the morning.
Oh, my God.
It was the hardest. So we both have about 250 pounds on our back from that caribou.
Right.
It was the hardest hike we've ever had in our life. So it's a funny story. Josh and Sarah were watching us from another mountain on our hike back. This was like, I don't know, 6 p.m. or so. And they see us through binocs. And, you know, Jesse and I make it every 5 yards. And then we end up on our knees, like, taking a 10-minute break. Because we were so physically exhausted, we can't even move. So Josh thinks that Jesse broke his leg. So he comes running down the mountain to us. He's like, you know, what's wrong? What's wrong? Like, we're just tired, man. Just tired.
This is no joke.
The last mile, hands and knees, back to the camp. That whole next day at camp, we did not get out of our tent one time. Laid there the whole day, we laid in bed or on a cot.
Yeah, and that's one of the biggest misconceptions about hunters is that they're just some fat boy in the back of a
truck.
Yeah,
it's super easy, yeah. No, that was the physically most demanding thing I've ever done in my entire life.
Yep. Yeah. All for the pursuit of an animal. And not to mention there's murder pandas all over the place who want to kill you.
Yeah, so that was, you know, like I said, we've seen 40 grizzly bears and 5 caribou. So we were encountering, you know, 8 grizzly bears a day, whatever it may have been. So I shoot my caribou on the last day. Somehow, by the grace of God, a miracle happened, and this caribou happens to come out on the last day, and I ended up shooting it. So I set my bow and my backpack down, and we go walk out there to start cutting up the caribou and getting it packed back up to camp. And we're standing over it, you know, taking photos. We're all having a good time. And I look back on the hill. There's 3 grizzly bears right at my backpack and my bow. And they're flipping my bow. And every single time they throw it up, it goes like 10 foot in the air. It comes back down and crashes. And
3 of them?
Yeah, there's 3 of them.
They hang out in groups like that when they're...
This was a sow and cubs. So there was a sow and 3 cubs. And the cubs were 2 years old. So, I mean, you know, for a grizzly bear, I call them cubs. They're 800-pound bears. They're huge bears.
Right.
And I left Pop-Tarts in my backpack. They destroyed my backpack. We're watching this all happen. You know, my bow's flying up in the air. They're like playing with it like it's a toy. And then they rip apart my backpack and eat all my Pop-Tarts.
The more we talk about bears, the more I absolutely hate bears.
Yeah, no. Every single nightmare you've ever had about a grizzly bear is 100% true. Like, they are not scared.
Like that movie, The Revenant, where he just gets absolutely destroyed. Except for the only thing is there's no way he'd survive in reality.
No chance.
There's no chance. I mean, so look at those things.
So get this. Tim, you know, Tim is the craziest guy we've ever met. So he was in Africa hunting, I want to say 2 years ago, and he was hunting with a spear. Well, he's up in his tree, right? You know, he's up in a tree because he was going to spear whatever animal came by the watering hole. He decides to get down. I can't remember if he had to use the restroom or whatever it may be. So he's climbing down the tree. And he accidentally hits the tree, and his spear is sitting up there in the crook of a branch. It falls and goes through his leg.
You're kidding.
No. He almost bled out in Africa. He was there for 12 hours because no one was coming until the end of the day. His radio was up in the tree, so he couldn't radio anyone. The spear is through his leg. Almost bleeds out.
If that's not enough to not hang around this guy, I don't know what is.
Oh, he's an absolute ball to
hang
around.
He's an animal.
Crazy.
Yeah, I mean,
you guys need to get him on here. I promise you, he's an interesting character. He's awesome.
Tim Wells?
Yeah, Tim Wells.
Okay, well, Tim, let's get you on the show because we got to really talk to you, my friend. I got to know more about what you're doing. But one of the funny things, we've got a mutual friend who was kind of telling me some stuff about you, and he was saying, you need to talk to him about his relationship status. And so I started poking around on Steven and kind of his romancing, and I will tell you, there is no better poster child for FarmersOnly.com. He has got the most exciting Farmers Only profile that I think I've ever seen. It's dead right.
Yeah,
sexy.
You know, you think I'd end up being married by now, but I'm still working on it. I don't know what the deal is. Thanks, Dustin, by the way, for...
Yeah, shout out to Dustin.
Thanks,
Pointer.
Dustin, for making sure to get that personal jab in there. Really appreciate it.
But, I mean, I'm sure with everything you've got going on, it's got to be so hard to have a functional relationship.
Yeah, it is. You know, we stay pretty busy, you know, like I said, with all of our different business ventures and all the different hunts. Not able to hold a very steady relationship. In fact, my last one, crazy story. I'm not sure why it ended, but I'll tell you a little story that happened in the middle of it, and you can make your own guesstimates as to why. So I had a buddy up actually from Chicago to hunt with me, deer hunt. And so whenever he gets out here, super nice guy. He's one of my great friends now, but I didn't want to put him that high in a tree stand. You know, generally we're 25 feet up off the ground. Well, I didn't know a whole lot about him at this time. This was the first time I'd actually ever met him. He owns a deer feed company. He was coming out to see the operation, and it happened to be deer season. He's like, hey, you know, let's go hunting. My girlfriend was up at the time, and I was like, all right, I'm down for that. So we go out there in the middle of the day. I put his tree stand up 7 foot off the ground. You know, not very tall. I'm usually 25 foot up, so this is like I can touch up and jump on the tree stand, basically. And so we go hunting that night, you know, him, myself, and my girlfriend at the time. And it's dark. You know, we'd seen a bunch of deer, didn't have any luck though, so we're gonna go back to my house and eat. So we get down out of the stand, and he gets down out of his, and he's 7 foot up. He grabs onto his stand, starts climbing out. Instead of stepping onto the ladder for the stand, he steps onto a branch, and it's a dead branch. So whenever he steps onto it, it breaks, and he wasn't holding on good, so he fell. And somehow from 7 foot to the ground, he ended up upside down, like on his head. So he hits with his head in his shoulder, and he's like, oh, you know, that knocked the wind out of me. And I'm like, man, are you all right? He's like, yeah, I'm good. And so we're like, okay, well, you know, nothing of it. You know, that was kind of funny. I'm glad you didn't get hurt. So let's go back to my house and eat some dinner. So we're back in my house eating dinner, and girlfriend at the time was making lasagna, and she needed a pan. And so I was like, hey, I'll run uptown. You know, you guys just stay here. I'll be right back. I'm going to run uptown and grab a pan. I'm halfway up to town, and she calls me. And he's like, hey, this guy just passed out on your couch. Like, he's out cold. I'm like, what are you talking about? You know, we were just watching TV. And she's like, no, you need to get back here, like, right now. And so I didn't know a whole lot about the guy at the time. Like I said, we're great friends now, but at the time I didn't know much of him. And I was like, this is weird. So I get back there, and she had put a washcloth on his head, like trying to cool him down. This dude is white as a ghost. And we're like, what is going on? And, you know, she continues making lasagna. I thought the guy was being a baby. So yeah, at the time, I'll tell him this. I thought he was being a baby. I was like, yeah, you know what? He's a city slicker, not used to hunting. You know, I was like, he fell out of a tree stand. He's a little sore. I was like, he fell 7 foot. There's no way he's hurt. So, you know, he's laying on the couch with a washcloth on his forehead, and my girlfriend and I are sitting there eating lasagna. In fact, I think we both poured glasses of wine. Like, you know, this guy's laying on the couch. I'm just eating dinner.
Almost like he's not even there.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly.
Considerate of you guys.
I know. And so, you know, I'm sitting there like texting him, like, this guy needs to go. Like, this is weird. You know, he's like, I don't feel so good. I'm like, he's being a baby. And we have this lodge that he was staying at about 5 minutes from my house. And so, like, I'm pushing him. I'm like, hey, man, you probably ought to just go get some sleep over there at the lodge. He was leaving the next morning. So I was like, yeah, just get him out of here so I can go to bed. And he's like, yeah, you know what? That's probably a good idea. So I'm sitting there eating dinner, and he's on the couch. He's like, yeah, I'm going to head on out of here. He had his vehicle. Dude stands up. Passes out as soon as he stands up, hits his head on the corner of my TV stand.
Oh, no.
Yeah, so at that point, I was like, yeah, you know, something's wrong here. And so I pick him up, and I'm like, he's like eyes in the back of his head, you know, ghostly white. I was like, yeah, like he's fixing to die.
Got to go to the hospital.
Yeah, got to go to the hospital. So I pick him up. I'm running out the door. I leave my phone on the table. I'm like, hey, we got to go to the ER, right? So walk him out the door. I have this glass sliding door. I'm carrying him out there. He's passed out, completely out cold. I think I hit his head on the door trying to get it open. Oh, it was an absolute nightmare. Like, I'm swinging him out the door, and his head's, like, banging against the door. I was like, oh, my God.
So he's a good 25% worse when you started helping him.
Oh, yeah, 100%. So my girlfriend opens up my car door. It's raining. Like, you know, it's a rough night. It's super cold. I'm carrying him out there. He's passed out. Well, he shits on me.
What?
Oh, yeah. As I'm carrying him, he shits on me. And that's a true story.
I'm sure he's so happy to know that you're talking.
Oh, yeah, I mess with him so bad about it now. This is the first day we ever met. And so, yeah, I mean, that's how close he was to death. Like, literally lost his bowels on me. And so I put him in the truck, and I'm like, did he shit on me? I'm like, all right, you know what? I'll worry about it later. Let's go. So we hop in the truck, and we're going down to the hospital. I'm flying down there. We're going to the ER. It's, you know, 20 minutes away. And I get pulled over by a cop. Yeah, because I was speeding. So this cop gets out of his truck, and I'm like hanging outside my window. I'm like, dude, I've got a guy dying in here. I need a police escort. Well, the cop, you know, runs up to my window. He doesn't really understand what's going on. I open up the back door, and he sees the dude like passed out back there. And he's like, oh my goodness, you know, I'll give you a police escort. So I follow him, and this is how much of just an absolute shit show, literally, this night was.
Literally and figuratively.
Yes, literally and figuratively.
Shit everywhere.
The cop misses the turn for the hospital. Because he was a new cop in the area, so he didn't know where the hospital was. So, like, I'm following him, like, man, he must know a back way to the hospital. We get lost going to the hospital. So he pulls over on the side of the road. He's like, I don't know where the hospital is. And I'm like, Well, I know where it is. I thought you were, had like some secret back way. So then we get back on the road, get to the hospital. And, you know, as soon as we get there, this dude's blood pressure is, you know, his temp's like 90 degrees. I mean, he's fixing to die. And ends up, whenever he fell, his elbow hit his spleen and almost cut it in half. So he
had a ruptured spleen.
Yeah. It was cut in half. He had lost 2 to 3 pints of blood internally.
Holy hell.
Yeah. They ended up flying him down to Kansas City to KU Medwest, which is one of the best hospitals in the country. Stayed there for like 2 weeks. This was over Christmas.
Did you come back and say, look, I called you a pussy to my girlfriend, and I feel so bad about this.
It was horrible.
By the way, you know the concussion you had? That was me too.
I was doing everything I could to get this guy to go back to the lodge and just go to sleep so he would leave the next morning. I was like, good God, you know, I was going to kill the man if I let him go over there and fall asleep. You know, thank goodness he passed out when he stood up. But yeah, that was is an interesting situation. For some reason, my girlfriend at the time told me I was cold-hearted.
And then what he didn't say is the reason she broke up with him.
Isn't that weird? That relationship didn't work out after that. I don't know why.
So surprising. No well, way. Yeah. You know, they went on a date and he picked her up, carried her the same way, hit her head on the door too. That was the end of the relationship.
Yeah, you know, crazier things have happened. Boy, so I've learned my lesson since then, at least.
Quickly. Man, and so now you're good friends with him. I mean, does he ever just be like, you know, you're almost the guy who's responsible for my death?
No,
you
actually.
Insensitive bastard.
Actually, I don't know if I've ever told him the backstory behind it. He only knows the story was I'm the savior that took him to the hospital.
And so when he hears this, he's going to be like, that mother.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, 100%.
That's where that dent came from in my skull.
Exactly. It's like, I can only have like 10 seconds of memory. I have no idea why.
Yeah, whoops. So between the romantic escapades, a coffee company, farming, hunting, I mean, what else is going on that is in the life of Stephen B?
Man,
I call you Stephen B.
Yeah, you know, we just we try to stay as busy as we can. You know, I hate to use the term YOLO, but it's true. You know, we all only have one life to live, and so, you know, we're trying to attack it with a vigor, you know, that no one can match. And you know, I may not be the smartest in the room, but I always say I can outwork anyone and I can control my attitude and my effort. So, you know, that's what we're trying to do constantly is just work as hard as we can.
You see this room right now? There's a strong possibility you're the smartest in this room.
Yeah, I don't know. I usually can't say that, but in this room, that might be a possibility.
Hey, the seats aren't that comfortable either. That tells you how smart we are. We pick terrible chairs. But this coronavirus thing has thrown a wrench. We talk a lot about how it's affected rodeo because it seems like every day a rodeo is getting canceled. What has been completely just wrecked in your world from all this nonsense?
Yeah, you know, it's absolutely tanked the corn prices. So, you know, whenever we're looking at commodity prices each year, generally there's outside influences that affect the commodity price. And this year it was definitely the coronavirus. So the shutdown of travel, it killed the ethanol. Obviously fuel prices are down, killed the ethanol prices, which in turn kills corn commodity prices. And then also, like I talked about, the South Africans coming into work on the work visas, we weren't able to get them in, so we're running about 15 to 20 guys too lean. So it's made it a little tougher on us. But as far as, you know, like business shutdowns, like what a lot of people are dealing with, we're deemed essential. So it hasn't shut down our day-to-day. We're still able to roll like we usually would. Parts are a little harder to come by, you know. And a lot of those parts, especially coming from overseas, you know, it seems like those are a lot more difficult to come by. And that I wish here in the States we had a little more manufacturing about right now.
Right. And I don't want to get too political, but you're actually pretty well versed in politics to a certain standpoint. It's going to be no joke where you stand, as most of our listeners stand on that. Mm-hmm. But I mean, being in the industry that you're in, how important do you think it is that we actually do get the manufacturing back? I mean, it's got to be probably at the top of the list for most important things that happen.
Oh, 100%. Not only for, you know, like I was telling you on the ride over here, this virus, luckily, it's not, you know, like a major war or incredibly fatal. You know, the fatalities are under 1% for this virus. So it's more of a wake-up call than anything else. And I think it's a good wake-up call because Trump has been preaching for 2 to 3 years now that, hey, we need to get American manufacturing back here in-house, you know, have our manufacturers come back here, you know, stop all this outsourcing to China, Mexico, whatever it may be, because what happens if we're in a trade war with one of them and they shut down everything? So China right now is currently restricting the masks that they're sending over here, the N95 masks, for quality control reasons. So what happens if we have quality control reasons for something essential? 98%, like you said earlier, 98% of our medications, our prescriptions are filled from Chinese manufacturers. So what happens if they just decide to shut those off?
Well, I think that's probably been the biggest wake-up call of this whole thing, is how out of our control that stuff is. Mm-hmm. And we can, as consumers and dependents on a lot of those things in this country, mm-hmm. I think we all kind of need to do our part to push to get those things going.
Yeah, so. Absolutely. And I mean, it's, as Americans, obviously bringing the manufacturing back in-house with all the labor unions that we have, it's going to increase prices of products. But we have to decide if the trade-off is worth it. And in my opinion, it completely is, to get that in-house manufacturing and get it out from overseas to where we're not dependent on other countries for, any of our essential goods and services.
Right. So. I mean, you and I might just be another citizen in the country, but it just doesn't seem like a common sense thing to rely on a communist regime for things like antibiotics.
No.
Right?
No.
To save a few bucks from manufacturing. Now, I'm not educated on that at all, so I shouldn't speak to it too much, but it's a very odd thing.
Yeah. No, it's 100% true. And, a lot of, where we sell our grain. So, for instance, we grow 5,000 acres of white corn that's put on a rail in Kansas City and goes down to Mexico, and it's made into tortilla chips or flour tortillas. And then most of our soybeans are actually exported to China. China is currently the largest buyer of soybeans. In a trade war situation, they know that for Trump, a lot of his supporters are in the ag industry, the industry that we're in. And so they're going to try and hit that the hardest. So, they stop purchasing those, soybeans, corn, whatever the grain may be. And it kills the farmers, and it makes us, what they're trying to do is make us, not support Trump, go against Trump, because we're like, hey, Trump, because of Trump, all of our prices are being killed. But what they don't understand is that we know, what they're doing, and we want to bring that manufacturing and those in-use products back into the United States. And so, I think you'll see that the farmers are more supportive of Trump than ever at this point.
I mean, how could they not be? I mean, he's literally marching with the farmers in his own addresses, talking about it. And I just really, truly, truly hope that people understand how important it is to support our local farmers like you and other outfits. Cause I mean, I think you are the largest organization in the state of Missouri. I mean,
we are, yeah. So we are the largest farming organization in the state of Missouri, farming the 42,000 acres that we farm, and we don't have any intention of slowing down anytime soon. So if we can handle sustained growth, there's not a ceiling on where we're going to stop at. We're going to continue. We enjoy what we do. We like working hard, and so we're going to continue doing it for sure.
Oh, absolutely. I cannot wait to see what your future is like here. And on our next episode, maybe we do another one here in a year to follow up.
Yeah.
Because you told me something that I thought was unreal. Your growth from 2019 into 2020 was like a number that I would have expected to be the opposite.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, absolutely. Like I told you, with all the grain prices, tanking like it is, there's market share to be captured. And we're trying to capture that right now. We know the margins aren't very good in the farming realm right now, but we think in future years, with population still growing, we think by 2027, there's going to be a flip where there's more people in the world, and obviously supply and demand situation, with more demand, there's going to be higher prices. So we think farming is going to come back around, and we're looking forward to it. But not only that, we have several different startups that are coming in this year that we'll definitely want to keep our eyes on and talk about a little bit more maybe on the next episode.
So. I hear you. I can't wait to do another one with you. And I'm not trying to wrap it up by any means. Mm-hmm. With this coronavirus going on, did you have hunts that were planned maybe that are now completely just off the table?
Yeah. We were looking at going to Africa again. Obviously that's off the table. Looking at several other trips, looking at a New Zealand trip, that's off the table now. But in the grand scheme of things, those are just minor, setbacks.
Minor setbacks.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, compared to what the economy's doing right now with the, basically 21 million people laid off, that's the least of our worries.
And I think it's actually climbed. We pulled the statistic on one of the other episodes. I think it got to 30 million point. 30 million unemployed.
Yeah. It's something that, in my opinion, we've got to get this economy back and roaring.
Yeah, I agree. I think we're at the point where the damage to the economy now completely and totally outweighs the damage from the virus.
Absolutely.
Being that it's a, what is it, a 99.8% recovery rate?
Yep, absolutely.
So we're at that pivotal point where, okay.
Yep.
And thank God for the governor of Texas is getting things open back up. And
yeah, absolutely. Well, and I think Trump's understood that the entire time. You know, he keeps tweeting, we can't make the cure worse than the problem itself.
Right.
And so I think he's understood that. You know, he's done what he's could, what he can do. And now he knows, hey, we got to get this economy back open. Otherwise, you know, we've got bigger problems than just the virus itself.
Right.
And that's what I think a lot of these, you know, liberals don't understand is that, you know, if we tank this economy, we're setting back generations. You know, we're going to be setting up people for poverty for generations to come, depression. You know, we are social beings. And so whenever you quarantine us, you're going to have depression through the roof, suicides through the roof. And in my opinion, we're going to do way more damage than the virus ever will by being in this quarantined social distancing state with the economy shut down.
I agree. And I will be the first to say that I have not really been quarantining like maybe they're suggesting, but it's because I've got too much going on. Mm-hmm. And even just the idea of it has me just kind of sitting there staring at the bottles, if you know what I mean.
Yeah,
because it's just absolutely. Like, what else is there to do? Not being able to get a haircut.
Yeah,
I can't tell you how much I miss sitting in a restaurant.
I know. I've been telling people I will never take for granted again just going out to a nice restaurant and enjoying a nice dinner.
No,
it's crazy what's happened here the past few months. And it's not, you know, a lot of people are always like, oh, so you're a, you know, conspiracy theorist. You don't think this virus is real. I absolutely think it's real. I know it's real. You know, and I know the damage that it's doing, but I also know the damage that it'll do to the economy if we keep shutting down, you know, if we're continued in a shutdown like we have been, and it's way worse than what this virus will ever do.
Right, so, right. It has nothing to do with conspiracies. It's a real sickness, but the damage that's caused, just like you said, by a wrecked economy is something that could take decades to repair. Yeah,
absolutely, so, absolutely.
Steven, it's been so much fun chatting with you, and, you know, we'll chat some more tonight and all that, but... Dude, I'm telling you, I can't wait to have you on again. And thank you so much for taking the time braving the airport.
Yeah.
Don't cough.
Yeah, no doubt. No
but,
doubt.
It's actually, it kind of seems like the airport might be a safe place because there's no people.
There's no one there.
I picked you up from the airport and you were the only person I saw.
Yeah, that's like, the fastest I've ever been in and out of an airport. Yeah, it was awesome.
You're completely safe. But thanks for being on the show. And yeah, we'll have so much more to talk about. We're buddies now. So
that's right.
We might have to go on a hunt together or something. But thanks for making the trip, and let's wrap it here.
Yeah, thanks, guys, for tuning in. I look forward to, you know, the next episode. I think we'll both be in a little different walks of life by then. Hopefully,
I think,
you know,
so.
This podcast is taking off, and our startups are doing well on my side, and we'll have a lot more to talk about.
Oh, man, so. I can't wait. Yeah, absolutely.
Where can they follow you on social media?
Oh, yeah, so my Instagram username is at Stephen McBee. So that's Stephen with a V, and McBee is M-C-B as in boy, E-E. So if you guys want to hit that follow, I'd appreciate it. Certainly appreciate it. I promise I won't get too boring, and there'll be good content to follow.
Yeah, and if you think that's exciting, you should check him out on farmersonly.com.
Yeah, that's right.
It's Steven_farmy_sex.
Yeah, you know, I need to get some better photos up there, I guess.
Yeah, the hunting photos aren't doing too well on Tinder either.
But. Yeah, exactly.
This has been The Gauge, hosted by me, Chance Conrado, produced and edited by our guy, Ty Yeager. Shout out to the executive producers, Dustin Pointer and Cody Denton. Marketing and content produced by Casey Burke. Our theme song is by Shay Ashire and the Night Howlers. Make sure to rate and review this podcast, as well as follow The Gauge on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. And make sure to subscribe to The Gauge wherever you get your podcasts. We'll see you guys next time.